true for me, but not true for you? In quotes, moral relativism and public life. So that's the topic. This talk is about relativism with a special focus on moral relativism. First, I'm going to try to explain what relativism is. Second, I'm going to make some remarks concerning what people are relativists about. Third, I'll say a lot of things about moral relativism. And fourth, I'll make a brief remark about interfering with other people's decisions, which may not seem relevant yet, but you'll see. And then I'll be done. So, introductory remarks about relativism. Relativism, roughly speaking, is the idea that there is not an absolute truth that's the same for everyone, but instead something is true for one person, but maybe not for another person. So, for example, someone might say, maybe it's true for you that sex should be reserved for marriage, but it's not true for me. Or, for another example, someone might say, maybe it's true for you that there is no God, but for me, there is a God. Now, right away, we have to be careful not to be tripped up by language. Sometimes in contemporary English, talking like that is just a way of expressing the fact that people don't agree. So someone might say something like this. For the Greek philosopher Plato, humans have a soul that survives death. But for the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, there is no soul. And all they would mean is this. Plato believes that humans have a soul that survives death. Hobbes believes that humans have no soul. So if they said that, they would not actually be asserting that one thing was true for Hobbes and a different thing was true for Plato. They could say all of that while thinking that Plato was right and that Hobbes was wrong, or the other way around. So right at the outset, we need to be clear on when we're really talking about relativism, and when we're using words that sound like a discussion of relativism, but are really just a way of talking about the boring old fact that sometimes people disagree. Actually, relativism rejects the idea that people disagree. If I say it's true for me that God exists, and you say it's true for you that God doesn't exist, we aren't disagreeing. It's similar to when I say that my favorite ice cream flavor is coffee, and you say that yours is chocolate. We aren't disagreeing. We're expressing our preferences. Likewise, if relativism is true, then when people say God exists for me but not for you, they aren't discussing disagreement. But in a way, they're sort of like floating the idea that people live in parallel realities or something like that. Now, to tell you the truth, I suspect that the very notion of relativism makes no sense at all. By that, I don't mean that I think that relativism is false, but something stronger. I suspect that relativism is meaningless. But I don't actually want to get into that in this talk. I want to assume that relativism does make sense, and then to discuss some issues. What people are relativists about, why people are attracted to relativism, and finally, why we can do just fine without relativism. All right, so what are people relativists about? A super strong version of relativism says that every truth is relative. It's true for me that eating meat is okay, but it might not be true for you. It's true for me that the Bible is inspired, but it might not be true for you. It's true for me that 2 plus 2 equals 4, but it might not be true for you. So all truths are relative. Let's call that view total relativism. Or you could call it global relativism. I'm going to call it total relativism. So total relativism seems like a hopeless theory. This is why. It undermines itself. If total relativism is true, then everything that's true is true only in a relative way, including total relativism itself. You see? But see, right, it doesn't make sense. If total relativism is only relatively true, then it might not be true for me or for you or whatever. So let's leave total relativism behind. It's not an interesting theory. Much more interesting and important are various types of what might be called partial relativism. A partial relativist theory says that some truths are relative, but not all. So, for example, someone might say that political truths are relative, but mathematics and physics aren't. Now, the first point to note is that partial relativism is not self-undermining. If you say that only some truths are relative while others are absolute, then you can say that partial relativism itself is one of the absolute truths. Partial relativism doesn't apply to partial relativism itself, but that's okay, because partial relativism never said that all truths are relative, just some. The second point to notice is that although partial relativism isn't self-undermining, that doesn't make it true. It might still be false, just for some other reason. A third thing to note is that there are many different possible kinds of partial relativism. For any partial realm of beliefs that you can think of, there could be a partial relativism that applied to that realm. So, someone could say that not all truths are relative, but moral truths are relative. Someone could say that not all truths are relative, but truths about art and literature are always relative. Someone could say that not all truths are relative, but the truths about religion are always relative, and so on. Partial relativism that focuses on morality or ethics is extremely common in our society. This kind of relativism is called ethical relativism or moral relativism. Many people believe in moral relativism, or anyway, they think they do. Because it's so common, and because in my opinion it exhibits something that's very important for relativism overall, I want to now talk about it in a pretty good amount of detail. Okay, moral relativism. Moral relativism says that although not all truths are relative, moral truths are. Claims about what is right or wrong, according to the moral relativist, are never absolutely true. They're only true for this person or for that person. It may be true for you that lying is always wrong, but that doesn't mean it's true for me. Now, why would someone believe in moral relativism? One reason you sometimes hear is this: people don't agree about morality, so therefore morality is relative. Or here's another version of the same kind of thought: you can't convince other people about right and wrong, so therefore morality is relative. Now, these are not good reasons for believing in moral relativism. Just because people can't agree on some truth doesn't mean that that truth isn't objective. It might be out there in all its objectivity and all its absoluteness without people being able to agree on it. Maybe it's out there but really hard to see. Maybe it's out there but some people are blind or stupid or whatever. Maybe it can be proved, but the proofs are really complicated and most people can't follow them. Maybe it can't be proved by anybody, but it's still true. So, in short, the fact of disagreement, or the fact that it's difficult to convince other people on moral questions, doesn't prove that there's no truth. It doesn't prove that there's nothing to disagree about or to prove. There's a lot more to be said about moral relativism and about whether it's true. To give a full account, we would have to start by thinking through important background questions like what morality is in the first place. Then we'd have to look at all the arguments that people offer for thinking that moral claims are relative. Then we would have to ask how those arguments could be responded to and what a good non-relative theory of morality would look like. To discuss all of that would take all night. In fact, it would take a number of courses, like entire semester-long courses. So you can't go into it all, although it does sound like a lot of fun. For our purposes here, we don't have to go into it. That's because, as far as I can tell, almost nobody actually believes in moral relativism. They may say they do, but they really don't. They don't, for example, think that it's just relative whether torturing small children is wrong. To their credit, if I said to them, well, torturing small children is acceptable to me, they would say, well, it's not true for you. And if you think it is, then you are seriously wrong. Now, I will admit, there probably are a few people who really do believe in moral flaw, in moral relativism. A few people. But probably they are all professional philosophers. And that tells you something. You're supposed to lie. Yeah. I mean, it takes a philosopher to believe something that crazy. So, I think that most people who seem to be relativists actually are something else. They are people who believe in moral non-relativism, but who use the language of moral relativism as a weapon for warding off certain evils. And it will be easier to make clear what I mean by giving an example. Okay. Let's suppose that you see three people in the street, and their names are Rocky, Nick, and Ella. Rocky is stoning Nick to death because Nick had sex with someone that he wasn't married to. He committed fornication. Ella thinks it's wrong for Rocky to stone Nick for committing fornication. So Ella says, hey, stop, Rocky. You shouldn't force your values on Nick. Don't you know that what's wrong for you might be right for him? Morality is relative. So you have no right to act in that way. Now, if you're having trouble keeping track of the names, Rocky is the guy who's stoning someone. Nick is the guy who committed fornication. And Ella is the relativist. Okay? See? Okay. So, I don't think it would be too surprising to hear Ella say these things. But notice something weird. Ella is telling Rocky that it's wrong to stone Nick for committing fornication. Ella is obviously not a moral relativist. But then Ella goes on to affirm moral relativism in her attempt to get Rocky not to commit a moral wrong. Ella is using moral relativism in order to support a non-relative moral claim. She's using moral relativism in support of moral absolutism. Now, I said this is weird. It's worse than weird. It's incoherent. It's self-undermining. Above, I said that moral relativism, whatever its flaws might be, isn't in itself self-undermining. And I'm not backing away from that. I am saying, however, that it is self-undermining to use moral relativism in defense of moral absolutism. If your appeal to moral relativism is true, then you shouldn't be using it to support a non-relative moral claim. In fact, if Ella makes that mistake, Rocky can simply turn to her and say, is morality really relative? Well then, it's right for me to bash Nick's head in. Now, why would Ella act in this incoherent and self-undermining way? For one thing, it's probably the case that she has not had a chance to attend enough talks sponsored by the Thomistic Institute. But I think there's something else going on here that deserves reflection Ella is trying to prevent Rocky from wrongly interfering in Nick's life. Ella thinks either that Rocky shouldn't interfere with Nick's choices at all, or that he's interfering in the wrong way. For example, maybe Ella thinks it would be okay for Rocky to ask Nick out for coffee and have a little chat about sexual morality, but that bashing Nick's head in is taking things too far. So we can distinguish Ella's tool from Ella's goal. Ella's goal is to protect Nick from a certain kind of illegitimate interference or harm. Ella's tool is the affirmation of relativism. Now, as we've seen, Ella's choice of tool undermines her goal. But we can ask whether a different tool might enable Ella to accomplish the same goal, namely the goal of protecting Nick. So I will now discuss two different tools that Ella could make use of. The first is the distinction between making an ethical claim and forcing people to go along with an ethical claim. You can think that something is morally wrong without thinking that it's right to force other people to conform to it. For example, I think fornication is morally wrong, but I don't think I have any right to force people not to do it. Likewise, you can think that something is morally obligatory, something that you're supposed to do, without thinking it's right to force other people to conform. I think that helping your parents when they are old is morally obligatory, but I don't think I have any right to go around forcing people to help their parents when they're old. Now, this distinction might sound obvious, right? The distinction between making a claim and forcing other people to go along with it. It might sound obvious, and in the abstract, I suppose it is obvious. But in practice, people are always getting confused. If you make a merely moral claim, people will sometimes say something like, "How dare you try to force your values on me?" So, for example, suppose someone says, "Yeah, I think it's wrong to commit fornication." The person who says this might not be trying to force anything on anyone, but we all know it would not be the least bit surprising if someone reacted by saying, "How dare you force me to act in accordance with your values?" This is not a logical reaction, but it happens all the time. Avoiding it requires real mental discipline. A special version of the distinction between making a claim and enforcing a claim is the distinction between ethics and politics. You can think that something is morally wrong without thinking it should be illegal. You can think, for example, that fornication is wrong without thinking it should be criminalized. Likewise, you can think that something is morally obligatory without thinking that the law should require it. I'll just keep recycling my examples. You can think that helping parents when they are old is morally obligatory without thinking that the law should require it. So ethics and politics are different. Again, this might seem obvious, but in practice, people forget about this distinction all the time. Suppose you say that a good corporate executive will guarantee that the highest paid person in the company doesn't make more than so and so many times as much money as the lowest paid person. I mean, this is the kind of thing that people sometimes discuss, right? Now, it could be 10 times more, 50 times more. It's just an example. If you said that sort of thing, it's pretty much guaranteed that someone will say, "Wait a minute, are you saying that the federal government should make a law and then audit every company to ensure that this happens?" But of course, you didn't say that. You said nothing about law or politics at all. You just said that this would be morally praiseworthy. Maybe you even said it was obligatory, but you didn't say that the government should force people to do it. And yet it's quite common for people to interpret statements in that way. You say something ethical, they hear something political. They aren't keeping in mind the distinction between ethics and politics. So it might sound obvious, but apparently it's not. And apparently it needs repeating. Perhaps you can guess already the way in which I think this is relevant to our topic this evening. I'll explain it in terms of both versions of the distinction. To begin with, making an ethical claim doesn't automatically require thinking that it's good to force people to conform to the claim. Rocky can believe that fornication is wrong without believing he would be justified in forcing Nick to conform. So Ella doesn't need to appeal to moral relativism. She can instead appeal to the principle that knowing that someone is acting wrongly doesn't give you a right to force them to act in a certain way. This is a much more logical strategy for her because it isn't self-undermining and coherent. Now let's look at the ethics and politics version. Politics inevitably involves the use of force to interfere in what people are doing, either to make them stop doing something or to make them start doing something. I don't mean that politics is nothing but force, but it's a special fact about politics that the application of force, or at least the threat of it, is essential to it. Ethics isn't like that. I can hold ethical views and make ethical claims without attempting to use the force of law. Now, the example we gave above concerning Ella, Rocky, and Nick isn't actually an example of politics. Rocky isn't a member of the police enforcing the law, but we can change the example to make it fit this part of the discussion. So suppose Rocky wants to make fornication illegal so that Nick will be thrown in jail. Ella might think that's a bad idea, and she might appeal to moral relativism to block it, but that's not a good strategy for her. She has a better strategy available, remembering the distinction between ethics and politics. She doesn't need moral relativism. In fact, she can firmly embrace moral absolutism, even moral absolutism about fornication. And then she can just say that although it's wrong, it's not the sort of wrong thing that should be criminalized. So she has an alternative tool for getting Rocky to not interfere with Nick's life in a way that seems wrong to her. So that's the first tool Ella could have used. And that tool has two versions, the non-political one and the political one, but the basic idea that they have in common can be summed up as follows. There's a difference between making a moral claim and forcing someone to go along with your claim. Once you see the difference, you don't need relativism anymore. Now let's turn to the second tool, the one that is nicely captured in the slogan, "Love the sinner and hate the sin." It's amazing how few people really understand this. Maybe it's because it's so hard. People often think, quite rightly, that we should have a loving attitude toward everyone. And they notice that people who criticize others' moral behavior often do so in a harsh and unloving way. So, in order to get people to act in a loving way, they decide that it's bad to form negative judgments about people's behavior. If there's no such thing as sin, then you can't hate sinners, because there aren't any sinners to hate. In other words, people like this see moral relativism as a pathway to love. That might be what's behind Ella's rebuke of Rocky. She wants Rocky to love Nick, not to hate him. And she sees that Rocky's mistreatment of Nick is rooted in the fact that Rocky doesn't like Nick's sins. So she tries to convince Rocky that there's no such thing as sin because moral truth is relative. And this will, she hopes, reorient Rocky's way of thinking so that he can love Nick. It's a strange but powerful fact that in this case, Ella has actually accepted the idea that we should hate sinners. Rocky thinks that we should hate sinners, and he believes in sin, so therefore he thinks that he should hate Nick. Ella agrees with Rocky that we should hate sinners, if there are any. But she doesn't want anyone to hate Nick, so she decides that there aren't any sinners. Maybe Ella and Rocky are both wrong. Maybe we shouldn't hate sinners. Maybe we should love sinners, but hate their sins. If Ella could learn to think like this, then she would not have to appeal to moral relativism to defend Nick from Rocky. She could point out that although Nick's behavior needs improvement, we should still try to love and help him. Resorting to relativism is not needed for this. I've just suggested two ways of thinking that would allow Ella to protect Nick without resorting to moral relativism. Before leaving this topic, I would like to bring up a possible objection to what I've been saying. Perhaps these alternate tools cannot be used in place of relativism as a way of protecting Nick from illegitimate interference, because perhaps even making and expressing a moral judgment is already a form of illegitimate interference. In other words, maybe the mere act of telling you that your actions are wrong is all by itself already an unacceptable interference in your life. If that were true, then these other tools wouldn't be enough. Now, my first response is to say that even if voicing moral disagreement was illegitimate interference, moral relativism isn't needed to block it. Instead, we could just have a moral rule that people should keep their moral judgments to themselves. In other words, we could say that morality is absolute, and it's okay for Rocky to disagree with Nick's behavior, so long as he doesn't voice this opinion. So if merely voicing disagreement counts as unfair meddling in other people's lives, the solution needn't be relativism. It could just be silence. My second response is to wonder about the psychological toughness of people who can't handle it when other people disagree with them. Now, I do understand that some people have thin skin, and I don't think it's nice to be mean to people with thin skin. But even so, having thin skin is a fault, not a virtue. I should be able to deal with it if you disagree with me. For example, I think it's okay to eat meat. Maybe you don't. Well, if you think that eating meat is wrong, you should be able to tell me that. Obviously, you should choose the right time and place. You should do it in a polite fashion. You should consider the possibility that it would be wiser to say nothing and let me figure it out on my own. Maybe you can tell that I'm so amazingly sensitive that I might have a nervous breakdown if you raise the issue. So you think that on balance, it's better not to. There are always specific considerations that need to be thought through. But it remains the case that in principle, you have a right to voice your disagreement. It might make me uncomfortable. It might make me feel a bit pressured. But part of being a grown-up is dealing with the fact that people don't always agree with you. If you can't get through life without requiring everyone to be really nice to you all the time, maybe you're the one with the problem. So maybe instead of resorting to moral relativism, you should go camping more. Or join the Navy. Well, anyway, do something that will toughen you up. It's just a thought. Okay. Now, above I said that Ella's appeal to moral relativism was incoherent. Inasmuch as she's appealing to it, to moral relativism, in order to make an absolute point about morality, but now I want to discuss a more subtle version of Ella's approach, one that might not suffer from this flaw. Maybe she isn't a total moral relativist. Maybe she's just a relativist about some moral issues. In particular, maybe her idea is this: morality is absolute whenever your actions affect other people. But when your actions affect only yourself, then morality is relative. In other words, this theory holds that interpersonal morality is absolute, but personal morality is relative. So, for example, the obligation not to kill innocent people isn't one of those things that's true for some people, but not true for others, because it concerns others. But maybe the obligation not to get outrageously drunk or not to use pornography, maybe things like that are examples of issues where it can be true for one person but not true for another. And why? Because those issues only concern the person who's acting. If my actions concern only me, you might say, then whether they are right or wrong is just true for me. Now, this theory is not self-defeating in the way that Ella's first approach was. However, there are three considerations that, in my view, make it seem pretty unimpressive. First, are there any good reasons for thinking that personal morality is relative? while interpersonal morality is absolute. It's just not clear why we should believe this. If it's wrong to harm others, why isn't it also wrong to help myself? If it's wrong to harm others, why isn't it also wrong to harm myself? Aren't I a person too? For example, repeated binge drinking will definitely hurt me, and that's wrong. The fact that the person is me shouldn't really be relevant. Second, the distinction between personal and interpersonal morality is not as clear as people sometimes wish to believe. If I harm myself, that will have spillover effects that affect other people as well. The idea that I can become lazy, hedonistic, and so on without this harming others is pretty naive. Third, I'm pretty sure that the real motive behind saying that personal morality is relative is the thought that actions that affect only me, if there are any, are actions that other people shouldn't interfere with. Well, if interference is the issue, then we should return to the points that we were making before. In order to argue that interference is bad with regard to a certain realm of action, it's not necessary to say that moral relativism holds sway in that realm. One can just as easily stick to moral absolutism, but then add that making a moral judgment doesn't mean forcing the other person to abide by it, and also that we can hate the sin without hating the sinner. So overall, even though there's no incoherence in the second version of Ella's position, the version that distinguishes personal from interpersonal morality, it's still not a very convincing position. Okay, let me take the analysis one step further. I have suggested that people adopt a relativistic stance or use relativistic language in order to block others from what they see as unjust interference. But there might be an even deeper issue here. There's a certain attitude towards life that I think is now quite common, and I call it feelings management. The idea of feelings management is that the task of life consists in managing your feelings so that on balance, they're as positive as they can be. Now, I've chosen the word feelings here on purpose to straddle emotions and physical sensations. Feelings management is concerned with both, and figuring out how they are related is a crucial task for feelings management. Running a marathon is pretty unpleasant, but having run a marathon gives you a sense of accomplishment, bragging rights, and so on. For some people, the negative sensations of pain and fatigue involved in running the race just don't outweigh the positive emotions at the end, while for other people, they do. And of course, you don't just have to balance physical sensations against emotions. You also have to balance physical sensations against other physical sensations, emotions against other emotions. It's very complicated. But feelings management is somehow about juggling all of your physical sensations and your emotions in such a way that overall, you end up feeling as good as possible. I think that for a lot of people, trying to live a good life means being a good feelings manager. You try to avoid feeling physical pain, but perhaps a little physical pain is a price worth paying for the sake of being healthier. You enjoy your successes, but you try to avoid gloating about them, because when others feel bad in comparison, then you feel guilty. You try to avoid feeling guilty, but maybe a little bit of guilt helps spur you on. But the ultimate test of the whole thing is how it makes you feel. Now notice when I gave the example of running a marathon, I noted that running a marathon seems to be a good choice for some feelings managers, but a bad choice for others. What works for you might not work for me. So this really does seem to be a place where relativity holds good. So if all of life is about feelings management, then anything that affects our feelings looks like a candidate for relativism. And moral judgments affect our feelings. If a certain moral idea is too challenging, if I keep failing and feeling guilty, or if adhering to that moral judgment means I'll have to miss out on pleasures that I'm unwilling to give up, then I can just say that that moral ideal isn't true for me. Moral relativism is great for minimizing and even eliminating guilt. On the other hand, if I like behaving a certain way, then maybe I'll decide that this way of acting is right for me. And then I'll feel even better about it. I'm doing what's right for me. But you see, if you approach it this way, there's not going to be any absolute moral views. They're all going to be relative. Now, there's certain deep philosophical issues that are hard to argue about. And I think we're getting close to one of those philosophical issues where it's hard to come up with arguments. It's just a question of getting people to see things differently. I don't think that living a good life is a matter of feelings management. I think it's about fully living out the kind of being that we are. And what we are is a rational animal of a certain sort. There's a way for chickens to flourish or to fail to flourish. There's a way for humans to flourish or to fail to flourish. This is sort of a Thomistic thing to say, that morality is a matter of flourishing. And if that's right, then feelings management is the wrong approach. The goal of life isn't just to feel good, because we all know you can feel pretty good while doing things that are not good examples of being human. Okay, let me get back briefly to interfering with other people. I've granted that some interfering with other people's lives is bad, but I don't want to give the impression that I think it's always wrong to interfere with other people's decisions. I think it's fairly clear that sometimes it is acceptable and even obligatory to tell someone that they are going astray. I know that my life has been improved by other people calling me out on things, and I hope I would have the guts and the charity to do the same for other people. Also, there really are times when we have to not just tell people that what they're doing is wrong, but to stop them. Sometimes we really have to intervene. In the silly example I gave earlier, Ella should not just argue with Rocky, she should grab his arms, make him stop stoning Nick. And there are, in fact, times when immoral behavior should be criminalized. Stealing cars or shooting people should be against the law. So, now, I have not really said anything about which things you should interfere with and which things you shouldn't. That's a super complicated issue. That's a whole 20-talk series of its own. But I just want to point out that in all these things about interference, I'm not trying to suggest that interfering is always wrong. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Okay, just about done here. Moral relativism can ultimately be overcome only through a positive view of what ethics is about. And a correct positive view. You have to see that life is not about feelings management. You have to see that ethical principles involve judgments not only about what's right and what's wrong, but also about when it is and isn't legitimate to interfere with other people's decisions. If we get all that right, then we'll no longer be tempted by relativism. Instead, we'll be drawn towards the truth. That's it. Thank you.
Doctor, so at one point in the lecture, you said that forcing an action is not necessarily the same thing as making a moral statement. But, it may be good to, incentivize a morally upright action. Maybe you're not, disincentivizing what you view as morally bad, but you're incentivizing what you view as morally good. Is that acceptable? And then follow-on question, when does that incentivizing the good action become disincentivizing the bad action?
Okay. You brought that up in the context of the distinction between telling people what they should do and using force. Something like that. So when you talk about incentivizing good actions, do you mean what do you mean there? Do you mean if you do this, then I'll praise you? Or if you do this, I'll give you money?
For the government, a tax cut within...
I see.
Having kids within marriage without marriage.
Okay, right. Good, no, it sticks with the example too. tough question. I like that question. You can, so it actually raises a lot of issues. So one thing is, you can certainly incentivize people to do good things, right? Teachers do that all the time. It's called grades. Right? I mean, most of us would prefer not to deal with grades. But the fact is, I used to be a student too, right? Like, if there were no grades, I probably wouldn't have studied quite as hard. Most of us are like that. So you sort of incentivize people. Now there's a kind of, it sort of automatically cuts both ways because there's good grades and bad grades, right? So in that case, you're both incentivizing and disincentivizing at the same time. But I see what you mean. You have to wonder where there might be cases where you could incentivize the good really, really strongly, and you don't do anything about doing things badly. But the people who are doing the bad stuff, or the stuff that you're trying to disincentivize, then they feel like they're totally being left out of the cold. And I could just say, well, I'll give you $1 if you do 10 push-ups, and you might go, forget it. And I say, I'll give you $100, and you go, all right. But the other people would be like, I don't want to do it. I say, I'll give you $10,000, and they might be like, whoa. Now they're feeling the pressure, right? So,
a true moral relativist never pass judgment and never get to
it? Oh, yeah, a true moral relativist would either not incentivize people in this way or would do it for non-moral reasons. Like, they might say, well, I want everyone to do these things, so I'll create incentives. Yeah. I think the question more is whether incentivizing things can be sort of, at a certain point, it becomes a kind of force. Is that the point? That you sort of make people an offer they can't refuse, so to speak, by just making certain things not so attractive. I think that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure what I would say about it. I think it can, one thing that could be a problem is if you over-incentivize things through external incentives, then you start to spoil the activity, Like, you want your kid, you want your kids to, do chores. Now, you could pay them. They'll do it. But now maybe you're starting to spoil the whole point of it. Depends on what you think the chores are for. If you think the chores are to teach the kids that when you live in a little community, you have to pull your own weight, then giving them money for it is not teaching them that lesson, right? So it gets the job done, but now they're sort of picking up on the wrong lesson. So that's an issue that's raised by incentivizing. I have to think a lot more about whether incentives start to become disincentives for people to go the other way. It still leaves people with free will. You can just pass up on the goodies if you want to. But it can become hard at a point. I got to think about that more. I like that question. Thank you.
I've heard claims against moral relativism that it's a logical consequence of being unable to uphold a moral absolute position or as a matter of convenience, especially having selective moral relativism about certain things. How would you respond to that?
Okay, so say the first thing again. It's a logical consequence of what?
Logical consequence of a lack of fortitude or some other virtue in order to maintain a moral absolute position.
Pardon? Yeah.
Or it's too difficult in order to maintain an absolute.
Right. Yes, I think there's something to that. Okay, now I just have to be picky here. I am a philosophy professor. It wouldn't be a logical consequence, right? It doesn't follow logically.
That was the claim. Is it logical?
I see. Well, I mean, it's logical in the sort of everyday sense of inevitable. So I think there is something to this. I actually do. I've got this idea that, I've read somewhere that I should, that it's a really good idea to be honest or to be in good shape or whatever. And I try it and I keep failing. And I'm just not getting the job done. Now, this makes me feel bad. Like, it really makes me feel like a loser. So one solution to this would be to say, that's a stupid rule. Who says being in good shape is important? That's stupid, right? And the real reason I'm saying this is because I have failed. So there, I think I do agree with this, that there can be a kind of, through one's own personal failure, you are led to deny the existence of certain moral ideals because you yourself can't achieve them. Does that make sense? I don't know if being in shape is a particularly good example, but there's this track out there I was thinking about. So, yeah, no, I do. I mean, this is a tricky thing because what we're doing is we're kind of psychologically diagnosing why some people would find moral relativism attractive. To do that is not actually to refute it. Like, as a philosophical position, and I have, in fact, in this paper, not claimed to refute it. But if you were going to refute it, saying that people hold it for a bad reason doesn't refute it. People can have bad reasons for holding views, and the views are true anyway. But I do. But I agree. Does that make sense? Okay.
Thank you.
Would you say it's, you know, along the same vein, it's easy to adopt a moral relativistic viewpoint rather than to make a decision?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I agree with that, that it's easier, in a lot of ways, it's easier to be a moral relativist than to make a decision, except I would add that I really do think that not that many people really are moral relativists. So when push comes to shove, all of a sudden they're not relativists anymore. You know, if you just tell them, well, I'm going to just take your money, it's right for me. Then they're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Now it's a lot more complicated. All of a sudden they believe in justice, right? So to be a real moral relativist, that would be really hard. That's why, again, I'm part of what I'm saying here is I think a lot of people use moral relativism. It's a kind of it's a pose that they take on when it's convenient for them. And maybe they're not being quite as cunning as this makes it sound. But when they need it, all of a sudden they're moral relativists. And they don't have to stand up for things. They don't have to disagree with people. They don't have to get into hard conflicts. And they don't have to make any tough decisions. They can just do whatever they feel like doing. But then 10 minutes later, all of a sudden it turns out that morality is super absolute, like when you're trying to take their money. Then they believe in it.
So Thomas Jefferson, I think, said, "What if you stand for everything, you fall for anything." So wouldn't, in that context, you say that moral relativism really isn't moral relativism? What it is one's defining the priority of morals, and some are worth negotiating, and some are worth being absolute on.
Let me think. If somebody held the view that some moral views are absolute and others are worth negotiating, as you're saying, then in a way, that might be a good view or it might be a bad view, but it's not moral relativism anymore.
No, it's not.
Yeah, okay.
Okay,
yeah.
Would that be the middle ground of moral form?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I would have to think more about what you mean by that these things need to be negotiable. Want to hold them.
Let me give an example, right? You know, you shouldn't kill somebody, but I can jaywalk.
Right.
Yeah, let's use that, right?
Yeah.
Take a big deal like
this. Okay, yeah. Well, one thing, this is helpful. Okay, so when you hold a moral absolutist view, all that means is that you think that there are some moral absolutes, that there are some objective right and wrong. But that doesn't mean that you think that all of life is governed by such absolutes. So I'm pretty sure that there's no moral rule that says whether you got to drink from the water bottle with your right hand or your left hand. Like, just do whatever you want, you know? And if it's, like, right for you, like, that's not a problem. So there's a lot of things where you can just do whatever. That you can be an absolutist and hold that, because absolutism just says that there are some moral absolutes, not that everything is governed by a moral absolute. So I could say, go ahead, jaywalk, I don't care. I could still be a moral absolutist and think it's okay to jaywalk.
Mm-hmm. I have a hypothetical question. Any event that, like, the U.S. government were to reverse their decision based on prior moral failures, such as like, you know, kind of controversial abortion or homosexual marriage, if they were to reverse their decisions on that, how would they justify that to a moral relativist population? How do they explain that? Because they are taking a stance. Like that's what's going to be a lot of...
Yeah. Well, gosh. So how would the U.S. government, if it wanted to sort of reverse course on some of these controversial issues, how could it justify it to the public? I mean, I don't know. I mean, how do they justify these things in the first place? A lot of things, maybe I shouldn't say this, a lot of things that get settled in public discussions, I mean, the level of the discussion is pathetically low. So, you know, everybody just has been mouthing a bunch of cliches, and then new cliches become fashionable, and so people mouth those, and movie stars say a few things, and then everybody just goes the other way. So maybe I mean, I know that sounds terrible, but I think there's a lot to it. So then it could just happen the other way, you know?
So look to history, right? How did we abolish slavery?
Yeah, well, that wasn't, I mean, that's a tale where you don't have to tell it in quite so cynical a way. That wasn't just, moral fashions changing. I mean, there was something more solid about that. I mean, that was very cynical what I said. And I sort of stand by it, but I'll add something on top of it. At the same time with all that superficial stuff going on, there are people who are trying hard to be serious. The way to convince people to reverse course is to think about, you try to find something that they already agree with, and you start from there, right? So, like, if there are people who, if you're trying to convince people that abortion should be criminalized again the way it used to be, you have to find something that they believe about human rights or about science or whatever that they already believe in. And then start there and work towards getting them to see that they ought to hold a different position. So, but this is important, right? Because you got to start from a starting point that the other person agrees with. Otherwise, you're just banging into each other. So it's sometimes quite challenging to try to figure out what is it that people think where I can make a bit of progress here. But that's how you make progress, not through propaganda, but through real discussion. Yeah.
All right. That's all the time we have for questions. Okay. If we could, a big round of applause for Dr.